Rockstar fuses blues rock with traditional touring and focuses them through a psychedelic rock lens, creating a sound that's raw, emotional, and elemental. More information about Modu Mokhtar at The Fine Line is available at first-avenue.com.
Listening to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM, streaming live and on the web at kfai.org. This is Right On Radio, the show where I talk about to local, national, and international artists about their craft. Today's guest is Mark Nowak. Am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Yep.
Yeah, perfect. So today's guest is Mark Nowak and his newly released book, again, by the local publisher here in the Twin Cities, Coffee House Press. Mark, you're also a frequent guest on Right On Radio, is that correct?
I was long, long ago, not in, I don't know, 15 or 20 years, but early on when a poet named J. Otis Powell had the show, I used to be on fairly regularly because I taught right down the street.
Oh, fascinating. So talk a little bit more about that. And then, that's for the first half hour. The second half hour, I'm also going to be talking a pre-recorded interview with Daniel Brozutsky and his book, The Murmuring Grief of the Americas. In a similar vein, this piece of prose depicts the collective grief of America as we go through militarizing police, immigration enforcement, and the natural decay and apathy capitalism. And we're just going to get started in with the interview. Mark, you said that we're okay with reading a little bit of an excerpt from your piece, right?
Yeah, I think I'll read. So the book is made up of five abecedarian poems in alphabetical order. So a prose poem for each letter of the alphabet. And I'll just read the very first poem I wrote, which is not the A poem, you would think, but the O poem. And this was like, so the first section of the book is called Fall, and it's about the fall of 2020. We're about 6 months into the pandemic at this point in time. The election, Biden-Trump election, is weeks away, and this is the poem. Oh, owls out in the woods behind Office Depot. The odds have been against us from the onset. Obedience, obesity, alcohol, opioids, owls out behind Ollie's Bargain Outlet too. Owls in the old oak trees out behind the boarded up Old Navy. Once the wind did blow through trees like these, and we were here to witness them waver. Overcast clouds, old evanescent decaying crops. October's over, and so is All Hallows' Eve. Corn stalks and gourds on the ground in the dimming daylight. Maybe we're somewhere in northern Ontario or on the shores of Lake Erie or Lake Ontario or any other ordinary place where once we held each other like only we could hold each other. Sure, it was ending. It would end. Sure, the malls would close forever. No more overtime and only so much overdraft protection. Everyone reading this now is eventually going to die. Just ask the owls. The ones out in the woods out behind the abandoned old spaghetti factory were cooked. Meth, maybe frozen fish sticks and banquet turkey pies from the Dollar Tree, vodka, OxyContin. In the pine grove out behind the shuttered old country buffet, just listen to the owls.
Thank you so much for that excerpt, Mark. I just kind of start off this conversation with, if you don't mind giving a little bit introduction about yourself and your career as a poet.
Sure. I, came in the early 1990s to the Twin Cities from New York, ended up getting a job teaching at College of St. Catherine, now St. Catherine University. Hello to any alums listening out there from my classes from 17 years of teaching at St. Kate's. And published my first books with Coffee House Press, and then had a chance to get back to the East Coast and back to New York, where I've been for about 15 years now. But Minneapolis Coffee House Press has continued to publish my books, and I have family living in Minnesota, so it's great to be on the air and talking with you tonight.
Thank you. What I kind of want to start off with is this piece is just incredibly timely. It's about MAGAism, Trumpism, and when I was reading through this, I'm reading through this through perspective of somebody who grew up in Pittsburgh, who has family in Western New York. I am recognizing a lot of the spaces and the places, and it feels a memoriam to the places where I grew up, where my parents grew up specifically. And I'm kind of wondering, when was like the process to, I want to start writing a book about this specific issue that we're going through right now?
The very first photo in the book is a photo when I got caught in a Trump rally in upstate New York on October 17th, 2020. I had written the owl poem, and I had always wanted to write one of these poems in alphabetical order. Mm-hmm. So I wrote all the poems that were in fall, and then January 6th happened. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I could write another series like this, call it Winter, about January 6th. And then about a year later, it was my wife's birthday, and in my hometown of Buffalo, a white nationalist shooter went into Tops Friendly Market, opened fire, streamed it on Twitch, and that became the spring poem. The first Trump assassination became the summer poem. The events kind of kept happening. And I said to someone the other day, the book came out a couple of weeks ago, and the Southern Poverty Law Center, part of the end of the book is about Southern Poverty Law Center, has been in the news. And there was another shooter at the hotel in D.C. where Trump and the correspondents' dinner was. So even though the book was finished like more than a year ago, it's again, this seems to keep happening over and over again.
I was thinking about your book recently when I think it's the Minnesota Star Tribune won the Pulitzer Prize for the Annunciation shooting photography. And I just sat there because I remember where I was during that time frame here in Minneapolis. And I'm assuming there were similar motions during the Buffalo shooting as well. And I feel like this is a piece of work, quite frankly, that I'm going to visit to a lot in the next couple of years during the Trump administration. So first of all, I would like to thank you for that. I feel like this is definitely going to be a coping mechanism, as I said.
Thank you.
But really, I kind of want to get more into some of the nitty gritty details of, so you mentioned like an alphabetical order. So every season has a letter. What was the idea behind that? Is that a common thing that you've done in the past works? Or
there's a form of poem called a ABC Darian poem in alphabetical order, but it's a form that goes back to it was used in the Bible. Mm-hmm. It was used in Chaucer. Mm-hmm. Contemporary poets have used it, and I've been kind of, for a long time now, since my second probably Coffee House book, which was called Shut Up, Shut Down, a piece on the Iron Range and that one and some other things, Reagan's air traffic controllers, firing the air traffic controllers. But I was really interested in this kind of like thickish prose poem. And I started writing those again, during the pandemic. And I like this poem in alphabetical order. And I thought, I wrote all those first ones, you know, like the one I read at the beginning of the show. And I thought, oh, that's a nice section of a book. But then, as I said, these events kept happening and I kept going deeper and deeper into the form. I kind of got obsessed with the alphabet. I had all these charts and graphs, you know, in the Winter Poem. I remembered when I was in high school reading Antigone and being obsessed with the carrion birds, the flesh-eating birds. And I was like, I wonder if there's a carrion bird for each letter of the alphabet, you know, and researched them and alphabetized all the carrion birds and brought those into the poem. It's just, you know, the alphabet is something that we learn to read with, you know, and if you go to kindergartens around the Twin Cities, you know, my daughter went to J.J. Hill, Montessori, and St. Paul, right? Like, I remember the letters of the alphabet up on the wall. And one time when she was in class in kindergarten, the teacher asked her, asked the class if anyone knew a word that began with the letter Z. And my daughter raised her hand and she said, Zapatista. We were very proud of her at that moment, as we still are. But, you know, that so the alphabet is like so ingrained in us, you know, it's like the encyclopedia is alphabetized, the dictionary is alphabetized. We learn how to read. A is for apple, B is for bear, C is for cat. There's something so elemental about it that to use it as a poetic form just felt right for this moment in history.
Especially since, as you mentioned, like again, and like kind of the circular, the way that you structure is like fall, spring, winter, summer, fall again. And I'm noticing like the alphabet is like kind of a circular thing that happens again. Once you go back to Z, you start back at A again. And so I thought that was a really cool bit of prose. The one question I had specifically, the one thing that really stood out to me, especially in the section of spring, was the in the book, it's like a faded gray where the shooter for this is about the Buffalo mass shooting. Google search images, like Google search and his search history, and then contrast that with the red, like the more intense blackness. What was it like just kind of going through the shooter's manifest and all that other kind of stuff? Because that's always something I always
So he wrote this 186-page manifesto, and a huge part of that was just him in his basement in a town called Conklin, New York, searching like body armor, weapons, bullets, gear, and making a list of that within the manifesto. And I don't live in Buffalo anymore. I live in the eastern part of New York, but I happen to live in the same congressional district, New York 19, as the shooter, right? And so I felt like when I was reading that, I was, you know, that's now the third section of the poem. So I was very much into the alphabetical order at that point in time. And I was like, I wonder what would happen if I just took all of these things he researched and alphabetized them, put them in alphabetical order, and then wrote a poem that kind of moved or cascaded through that list, right? And there's a kind of poetry called erasure poetry. Probably people listening have done it. A lot of people, we take a black magic marker and you kind of erase text. And I didn't want to completely kind of redact or erase what he had searched. That, like, I wanted people to know the kind of volume, the multitude of things that he had searched. Just like in the last poem in the book, does the same thing with lists of active hate groups from the Southern Poverty Law Center. I wanted to not just erase those or redact those, but lighten them enough so people, if you struggle, you can still read all of that and then have my kind of commentary on that, my critique of that, move through those grayscaled lists of words. So it was a sense of like not wanting it to even though I wished both of those things had never happened or would disappear, right? The shooter's manifesto and the list of hate groups. I didn't want to just use the poem to erase them. I wanted their presence to still be there. I think that's really important.
In the latter, and especially for the hate groups, I've also lived around different states and different areas, and I'm just kind of surprised how many places I recognized off like county lists, and that to me was very grieving. And from the Pittsburgh area, when it's just like Allegheny County pops up, and I'm like, oh, I'm really upset by this. Erie County for Buffalo, Niagara County, where my parents live in Niagara, my grandparents lives in Niagara Falls. So I'm just kind of like, I felt like this oversense of dread, and I actually never went through like the Southern Poverty Law Center hate groups, and I was always like kind of surprised, like, how much is like Trumpism is among us, especially since I'm more of an urbanite living in the Twin Cities. And the only time I really kind of experience stuff that's mentioned in the prose is definitely when I go visit like my more rural living relatives and things like that. But I noticed you've been doing a lot of work traveling, promoting the book now. You're on your book tour, so congratulations.
Thank you.
When you're visiting places like Binghamton, New York, and other areas, like traveling across the U.S., how do you feel like when you see Trump signs still out or while kind of promoting this and showcasing the book to different areas?
Yeah, you know, it's been I've tried to kind of keep my radar up as I move. So when I was just in Pittsburgh, for example, like a week or so ago, and my host very generously took me to the Tree of Life Synagogue, you know, kind of the site of another one of these mass shootings. I think it's important to, you know, I did a previous book called Coal Mountain Elementary with Coffee House again on a mine disaster in West Virginia. And one of the things that I ended up getting to meet the sister of one of the miners who died in that in that tragedy. And she told me she was so happy. She was so thankful for the book because it kind of kept the memory of that mine disaster alive. You know, like CNN and MS News or whatever it's called now, they kind of dash in for a day or two and they cover the story and they disappear. You know, it was true in Buffalo because, you know, the Buffalo mass shooting happened. And then like, I don't know, maybe 2 weeks later or less than that, the Uvalde shooting happened, right, in Texas. And so it was like already the news was on to the next thing. So as I travel around, I kind of, you know, try to you know, keep attention on the kind of things that I photographed, look for transformations in that. I mean, there's still a lot of, you know, the information that I document in the book is still pretty thick everywhere. And a lot of the book is also about these kind of roadside strips that are nothing but, you know, fast food restaurants and dollar stores and Dollar Trees and Dollar Generals. And I find myself on those a lot again, just kind of worrying about, you know, like, what does it mean that we don't have kind of beautiful architectural spaces to inspire us that we go into, you know, like we just go into these cinder block buildings for so much of our daily needs nowadays. And it's disheartening to drive through it, but it is where we are in America now.
And I will kind of make a point out in the next interview. Daniel makes a point about this in his book about banks just taking over spaces, like these older buildings and just all banks. And I think I just kind of want to point out like my favorite photo. It's on page 151 for O, and it's the guns. And then just right below is just hockey equipment. I don't know why, but I got like a reasonable humor out of that one.
Yes. And the guns is so big, right? The letters like, on the mirror across the whole second floor of that building.
Yeah. I just kind of want to ask a little bit more about these photos that you take and like just kind of the process, like how many photos, what to add, what to include, and really that kind of creative process, if you don't mind diving into that a little bit more.
Yeah, it's, you know, I feel so thankful that from my very first book with Coffee House Press, you know, before we had any of this technology, I mean, not even flip phones, right? I would go around. I was really interested in this, these photographers from the 1940s, 1930s and 1940s who were started doing these books that were referred to as photo texts. Wright Morris, Richard Wright, James Agee and Walker Evans. And this notion of like what it would mean to pair a photograph with a text, with literature. And that was something I started doing in my very first book and in all of my books. There are always photo texts within them. But now, you know, now it's so like we have Instagram at our fingertips. We have our camera at our fingertips. It's very different, right? I don't have to go around with a slideshow on an old machine with a fan blowing and clicking it as I go, which I kind of miss that analog sound actually a little bit. But I'm looking to kind of document, and I have for 30 years now, this kind of changing de-industrial, people want to say post-industrial, but yeah. I don't know. I feel like those strips of Dollar Trees and Dollar Generals are where we're at after industry. Yeah. Because, you know, if you go down one of those strips, I don't know, in rural Minnesota, yeah. on the outskirts of the cities where all of that is, just think of how many people are working at or near minimum wage across a strip of like a mile of those stores, right? Each one employing, I don't know, if it's lunch rush at a fast food restaurant, 10 people. If it's a dollar store, 4 or 5 people nonstop. And you go down that whole strip, there's all of these people working in all of those places. And we're not really talking about that a whole lot in literature, in the news, in journalism, what's left of journalism yeah. anymore. So I'm trying to kind of create documents about those parts of America that I think are missing from our day-to-day conversations.
As like my grandmother who lives in Lockport, New York area, like mm-hmm. that area specifically. So like when I'm going through a lot of these photos and I'm like, I recognize this on an emotional level, like not, obviously not the specific image because I do not have that kind of ability to do that. But definitely there's an emotional, like I recognize this in like rural areas of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I used to travel a lot around the state of Minnesota. And so it's like very obvious the basically the capitalism, late stage capitalism that we're going through. Mm-hmm. And happy birthday to Marx, I think is his birthday today too.
Yes, yeah. May 5th.
Yeah. So a little shout out right there. But kind of what I also wanted to ask was like when I'm going through this prose and like just kind of the short, jittery, almost mosaic or kaleidoscope of phrases that I'm kind of picturing this piece of prose. If you don't mind kind of going through like to include like where do you, why would you include like sentences in certain areas just or like short phrases in other areas to try to really kind of go a little bit more deeper into the writing process itself?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I was before I was a writer, I was a musician, mm-hmm. an electronic musician. So I played synthesizers and sang and programmed drum machines and things like that. But I was in a band with a guy who was in a percussion ensemble mm-hmm. for kind of like new music, new classical music and other music. And when I started working on this book during that period of like 2020 and then January 6th and then the Buffalo shooting, I found myself really drawn to percussion music, mm-hmm. right? Like listening to like John Cage's percussion and prepared piano music, but like the Art Ensemble of Chicago, Edgar Varese's Ionization, like these works that where the, like it just felt like people were like kind of smashing wood and metal and percussion instruments. And I wanted the prose to kind of have a feeling of a percussion ensemble as well, right? And so you used words like jittery, right? Which yeah. I think is a great one, and kaleidoscopic. Like yeah. there's a, you know, when you hit a huge, I don't know, metal cymbal, or if there's a percussionist hanging a sheet of metal behind them and with their mallet, they just smash that metal. That was kind of the sound I heard in my head of this historical moment.
Yeah.
And so I wanted the prose to kind of capture that percussion ensemble feel, mm-hmm. that there would be almost sentences and fragments and just single words, and they would all kind of spin together within the what looked like a kind of a rectangular paragraph on a page.
That's really, I didn't really, I guess, because I used to do drums as a kid, but like, yeah, there is like mm-hmm. connotation between like the short jitteriness, like kind of, I don't want to say almost deafening, because anybody who's ever played the drums know they're very deafening, very loud, mm-hmm. Very, let's say like your tendons kind of shake a little bit, or mm-hmm. just a very, it's a very destabilizing instrument. And it's like, just to be in the presence of it, it's like, yep, that's the drum machine. It's very loud. Do you still play any music or?
I did a little bit of voice pieces for this book.
Yeah.
But they end up sounding like there's an old kind of industrial, one of the first industrial bands, Throbbing Gristle.
Yeah.
kind of sound like Throbbing Gristle to kind of capture that sound. And, you know, I'd say the thing with the percussion, too, is it's like it's very, I want it to be like muscular like mm-hmm. that, right?
Yeah.
Like if you play the drums, like it's such a physical activity, right? Like you really feel your muscles working yeah. in a way that I just wanted that feeling in the paragraphs.
All right. Well, we have time for probably about one more question. I did want to ask you a little bit about your personal, the Writers Workshop group,
the Worker Writers School.
Yeah, Worker Writers. If you don't mind just mentioning about that, because I think our listeners would love to hear about that.
Yeah, so if people want to find out more, they can. We're on Instagram at Worker Writers School. There's a lot of stuff there for it. But I started this actually in St. Paul. Mm-hmm. When the St. Paul Ford Assembly Plant was closing, I knew people from the UAW, and I taught a creative writing workshop at the Ford plant on Ford Parkway so that people who are losing their jobs could write about it in poems. And that was really the inception of it. I've been doing it since then, almost 20 years now, largely in New York City, but elsewhere as well. And it's free monthly creative writing workshops for people who in New York City are taxi drivers, are baristas, some of the people organizing Starbucks, Domestic Workers United members, nannies who got the first Bill of Rights for domestic workers passed in the United States, street vendors, like, you know, people who sell food in carts in New York City, all getting together once a month to write poems. We publish them. We turn one of them into a neon sign. If you go to the Instagram page, you can see the neon sign. Mm-hmm. And we even projected poems on the Brooklyn Bridge. So taxi drivers who spent much of their life driving back and forth people across that bridge got their words projected on it May Day, International Workers' Day, 2 years ago.
Oh, congrats. That's really cool. And thank you again, Mark, for being on the show. I did make a little note on my question. It's like, it wasn't a question, but go Bills. If we're going to mention Buffalo.
Go Bills.
Yo, Bill.
Go Sabres right now.
Oh,
it's not cool to say in Minnesota, but
I've
waited 14 years for the playoffs.
My family's just ecstatic. All right. And then, Mark, you will be at Moon Palace Books next week, right?
Yeah, next week, Tuesday, hour before your show. So people can come to the event and then listen to you on the way home.
Yeah, perfect. And Krista Wax will be on next week. And obviously, if you can't make it to our shows, our stuff is pre-recorded. It'll be on the internet for about 2 weeks. And so you can check out Mark in person at Moon Palace, where he discusses his book again. Again. All right. Thank you so much, Mark, for being on the air tonight.
Thank you. Have a good night.
Yep, you too. All right, so I kind of messed up the camera. But we're good. We're good. Yep, sorry. Bye. Today's guest is Daniel Borzutsky and his poetry collection, The Murmuring Grief of Americas. Thank you so much for being on the air today, Daniel.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And just to get us started, Daniel's just going to read an excerpt from his book. Go ahead and take the mic, Dan.
Thank you. So this is from The Murmuring Grief of the Americas. And this poem is called Apparatus Number 519. The part, the whole, the dead, the corpse, the foot, the light, the flesh. The part, the whole, the dead, the corpse, the foot, the light, the flesh, the wage, the worker, the regulator. The lie in the code of the body. It broke on the edge of itself. I did not trust what I knew was true. That my eyes were blank, that my face was blank, that my bone was blank, that my body was owned by the shareholders, that the body was just meat now, that the body was just debt now, that time death was murmuring so loud and I could only hear the dead rain squeak the buzz, the machine, the breath, the hatred, the fumble, the finger, the blow, the key, the sun, the brain, the bubbling, the cooling, the box, space, the fold, the silence. I dropped all my capital in the supermarket. I was a young language with no verbs. I saw my stitches photographed from the inside. The police touched me, frankly. They took me to the mask, the shield, the armor, the stone that's placed on the grave, the body that's left in the ground, the mountain they moved to the city, the beach that sank in the city, the river that lost its water, the lake that lost its waves, the missing horizon, the missing halo, the children that disappeared into the face of time, the tower, fire, the crows, the sticks, the woods, the foreclosed mountain we climbed before they threw us into, another Wednesday, another Tuesday, another Monday. It's cruel to pray out loud, cruel to pray to a God who loves so discriminately, cruel to eat in public, cruel to sing when your neighbors can't speak, moan or whisper to the birth that refuses to drop, the death that refuses to rattle, the leg that refuses paralysis. Trust the hammer, but lose the nail. Have faith in the hour, but not the minutes. Don't speak the failed word, the wound word, if it's witness to the frozen, the frosted, the fickle, the inspected, the inspector, the hopeful, the hopeless, the crumbling, the growing, the decaying, the rooting, the sowing, the consuming, the fluid, the formal, the industrious, the callous, the lazy, the blank at the moment of blank. Be empty. Disguise your breath. Disguise the sponge that sops up the water, the body that destroys its bones, the body that fears its own fingers, the concrete flesh, the privatized flesh, the bank flesh, the murmuring blankness, the exhaustion, the suffering, the numbing, the weathering. I remember honey, but it's gone now. I remember seeds, but we have so few now. I remember the grass and the beach and the river, the bees and the ice, the lake and the mountain and its brokers, its board members, its collateral, its assets, its insurance, its expansion, its reduction. We cataloged the glaciers before they disappeared. We returned the earth to the investors, the anxiety to the anxious, the babies to the umbilical cords, the blood to the state and the bank.
Thank you so much for that reading. All right, just to get us started about this conversation, can you give us a brief overview of your work in general, or like how you became a poet, just a little bit more about you?
Sure. I've been at it for a while.
Yeah.
I've been publishing books for about 20 years mm-hmm. or so. I've written fiction. I've written several books of poetry. I translate from Spanish. All of those things are kind of mixed up together in the way that I work, translation, and my connections with Latin America have been very important to me. My family comes from Chile, and I've written a lot about the interactions between the United States and Chile and Latin America more broadly. In many ways, my books of poetry have been very interconnected, and I don't necessarily see them as being completely separate.
Yeah.
The Murmuring Grief of the Americas is a kind of continuation or latest installment of this project of trying to think about different kinds of economics and violences throughout the Americas.
So what I always was struck me by the title, The Murmuring Grief of the Americas, always kind of, I was attached to the word murmur. And I believe that also is a word that kind of reappears in your earlier works as well, as you mentioned, like continuation.
Yeah.
Can you just describe a little bit about why that word specifically kind of reappears a little bit over and over again in your bodies of work?
In some ways it has its roots in the novel Pedro Páramo by Juan Rulfo, a very iconic Mexican novel, which was originally going to be called Los Murmullos, or The Murmurs. And the murmurs in that book come from ghosts who are trapped in a purgatorial state. And because of essentially because of a corruption on the part of the local priest in the village who's conspired with the kind of a head honcho of Pedro Páramo of the village, none of them were able to be blessed into heaven. So there's a lot there. For me, murmuring, again, sort of does represent a kind of purgatorial state. It's not quite speech and it's not quite noise. It's somewhere between it. I do like to think of it as a kind of sound that is coming from the earth, from ghostly bodies, from bodies who are not necessarily able to articulate their conditions. And I think of it as, you know, as a kind of like low humming noise, which is continuous. There's something beautiful about the word murmur, right? Of the repetition of that murmur sound is sort of giving us like the actual sound of what the actual definition of the word within the actual sound of the word. And so for me, it's always been a kind of like uniquely evocative and mysterious word that evokes a condition of not a sonic condition, but also a condition of not being quite able to articulate one's pain and sort of being reduced to a non-verbal state.
Would you like describe it as like almost like a liminal liminal sound, almost like between when you mentioned like noise and silence? It's like kind of an in-between state.
Yeah, it's not like a scream. It's not like it's maybe like a moan, but it's not like it's not screaming, it's not whispering, it's like an attempt. It's like an attempt at all of those things that is transformed into its own particular noise. But I think it also, to me, sort of represents a noise that is like with us all of the time, and that is kind of trying to communicate both from within and the earth and from within our own worlds and societies.
I was also struck by the book and the piece of bodies as like a metaphor, like not owning your body, the state almost owning your body. And like, I think it's the quote, let me pull that up. All I ever wanted is to keep the police away from the outside of my body and to keep the police away from the inside of my body. Just like kind of ownership, who owns your body, quite frankly. And I think as like a cisgendered woman, like conversations of Roe v. Wade, these are also very, very common, I think.
Sure.
And I kind of wanted to use, like, why bodies as, like, throughout this piece as a metaphor? Is that something you've done in the past? Or if you can just, like, expound a little bit more about that.
Yeah. Yes, the body as a kind of unit appears throughout many of my books. In some ways, I wouldn't actually say that it's a metaphor. Yeah. I think I'm thinking about it quite literally and kind of thinking about, like you were saying, conditions of ownership, of who gets to make decisions, of how we think about violences that are done to large groups of people, right? In some ways, the sort of decision to use body as a kind of repeated word is a way of acknowledging that the kinds of that atrocities affect people in ways that people become anonymous as a result of the different kinds of oppressions and violences that we face, right? And of course, you know, news cannot like name the 670 people who have died in a attack or something like that, right? But it is perhaps my way of thinking that they are embodied, that they are there, and of giving them a kind of presence.
One of the things I like also, because your book is divided up into multiple sections, where when will I be human again? When will they be human again? That's, it feels, when I'm going through this, it's a very, I don't want to say depressing, but like emotionally validating, but also lethargic, recognition of like how the state or institutions in the Americas kind of like remove my humanity away. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if we can expound a little bit more about why to divide this up into like multiple sections and just kind of the more mechanical process of dividing up in the book into that.
You know, the book was written a while ago, and so some of those decisions are slightly further away. But I think just sort of broadly to answer your question, and the idea of humanity being taken away, I think a different way of thinking about that is a kind of overvaluing of the term human and of the term humanity, right? I mean, if we sort of think of like the humanities as this idea that art and music and philosophy will make us better. We only have to turn to Europe in the 20th century to understand that the same place that can create these wonderful traditions of art and thought are also murdering one another at the levels of millions, right? And so it's I think one of the things that I'm thinking about is like, what is the condition of being human? We kind of say like, the way we speak, we say, I value my humanity, or something like that, right? But humans have the very barbaric capacity of both being able to understand their actions and then committing them at the same time, right? And so I think what's going on throughout the book and the writing is this questioning of like, why do we put so much weight on that term? Yeah. Why are we thinking that that is the ultimate condition? And also kind of thinking about that in terms of non-human life as well.
That's a interesting response. I'm also kind of struck about like, not just like we mentioned, like, how will I be human again in like sections, but I'm really struck by the poetry, like Lake Michigan. Is that just because you live near Lake Michigan and like get to see like all the industrial portions of that? Does that influence a lot of the poetry?
I published a book in 2018 called Lake Michigan, which in many ways was something that I'd started prior. But that book was divided into scenes and acts as a play. And it imagined Lake Michigan as being turned into essentially a prison site, Chicago being turned into a police state that is overrun by immigration enforcement, and dividing people up into prisons on the beach in kind of racialized and ethnic manners. Chicago, of course, does become a police state that is overrun by immigration enforcement in fall of 2024. And it was not hard to imagine that such things might have happened. So I have been kind of writing and thinking about the lake in lots of ways over the past many years. I mean, on the one hand, Lake Michigan is this sort of stunning thing that exists in Chicago. On the other hand, it is the site of polluted water, of territory disputes. There have been racialized killings at the beach and throughout the beachfront history. It's also artificial in a sense, or at least the beaches are artificial. The sand was brought in from outside of Chicago to create this thing. So it embodies all of these things for me about the city, right? On the one hand, it's kind of natural beauty. On the other hand, it's the sort of artificial creation of that natural beauty, and also a lot of the kind of paradoxes and hypocrisies around both policing and economic discrimination that happened in the city.
I also was kind of, I'm thinking parallels to like when you mentioned earlier when you're giving your excerpt of documenting the glaciers before they disappear and like basically how, I don't know if I was like phrasing this correctly, but how humans kind of alter the space, like natural spaces. Is that something you think about a little bit as well? Or can you elaborate a little bit more about that?
Yeah, certainly. And that it is tied up. I mean, I think in the book, there is a violence that is happening as the result of state violence, as the result of economic violence. But I think perhaps what's a little different about this book compared to some of my other ones is like what you're saying, is that the sort of earth is speaking for itself as well. And the violence done to the earth is being intermixed with all of these other kinds of violences, and in a sense, not being separated from them, which of course we know that people of lower income and non-white people in the United States bear the brunt of environmental degradation at different rates, right? And so I think the kind of social, political, and economic violences are in our real world mixed in with actual environmental damage.
That's, I also kind of want to pivot the conversation a little bit where towards the end of the novel, what like kind of words that stuck out to me was like Earth State Bank Theater. And I'm just kind of curious if you can recall like how you came up with those terms, or I think I wrote in my notes as like Frankenstein words, kind of parts together, and just like how banks basically take over every other block, it seems, right across from the studio here on KFAI. It's like, yep, that's a bank. That's a bank.
Yeah, no, and that happens here too. And it's like, you can't remember what was there before, right? Like you can sort of walk around Chicago and like, and all the trying to figure out what was there before Chase Bank was there, right? And there are all these family businesses essentially, or you know, small businesses, and so that kind of gentrification and that kind of like intense financialization is also like a way of wiping out our memory, right? And of erasing a kind of cultural histories that exist. And so, and so that to me is what I am thinking about, right? And I'm thinking about the way in which, obviously, the way in which finance and the state and collude to do a kind of damage to the earth, but also the ways in which, like in the first piece I read, right, the mountains are owned, they have board members, they are being sold, right? And again, you know, we don't have to look too far to see that's what happens to water, and that is something that happens to land, right? And the result of that is total lack of caring for it, because it is a site of profit, right? And so so that's in some ways what I'm thinking about when I'm combining words in that way.
The other kind of more technical like written question I have was, I'm going reading through this, like an example I have like is Lake Michigan scene 525, where there's a line that says, "So many mechanical fathers," and then there's like a tab space, "So many cops," and then another tab space, "So many cannibals." And I was kind of curious, like, what do you think, like putting like kind of big chunks of spacing in between some of these phrasing is like, to like take a deep breath as you're reading through this? As I'm reading, it's like, it's forcing me to pause and kind of contemplate a lot of those stanzas and a lot of those words a little bit more heavily than some of the other lines. So I'm kind of curious the process behind that.
Yeah, I mean, there is, I don't know if I can say this as a fact, but I think there's probably not a period in the entire book. No, towards the end, there are periods in the prose poems at the very end. But through most of the poems, there is not a use of traditional punctuation, other than the occasional ? Right. And so spacing then becomes a way of using punctuation. And like you said, I think it is, it does two things. It does a few things. One, it sort of forces a breath on, forces a pause. Two, it introduces what I'm going to say is like a visual element to the work as well, so that you can kind of see the ways in which interruptions occur, the ways in which kind of blankness and space is occurring, right? And so, yes, I think as you stated, I think the point is to really kind of force a pause, but force and hopefully to sort of force a like looking around and a sort of awareness of oneself as you're reading as well.
I'm also kind of struck by the cover art a bit. I'm not sure how much of a process you had in that, but like, I like how it looks like a map. Like it looks
I drew it.
That's my drew it? Yeah. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Can you elaborate more on that?
Sure. I you know, and funny, like in 2023, I started drawing a lot. And it was never something that it was always something that I did for myself. And I still like know technically nothing about how to draw, but I was making a lot of these kind of map designs, and I was trying to think about the ways in which we might kind of remap territories in the way that if you sort of look at a map from the overview, it really seems arbitrary where lines get drawn. And so I was just trying to kind of rethink the map of the Americas as I was doing this, and trying to make it, I think, was visually interesting as well. Like, I've been told that it looks like a map, which is what my goal was, but I've also been told that it looks like a heart as well, or bodily organ too. And so so I suppose like the drawing process in some ways was sort of going along with the writing process. The only difference being like I was approaching art, the drawing, as like a total amateur, and it was a real joy to like be doing something that I actually had no part of the discussion in, or no kind of expertise or language about. And thus I was really able to do it quite a bit, and that was very fun.
I don't know if you're super familiar, but to me it looks like a watershed map. If you ever look at like watershed boundaries, on like state maps or anything like that, like there's like this organic like river tributary look to it that I always like thought it was really cool. It's like it's a very organic looking map, I guess, is like when you said like point to the heart, I'm like, oh, that's really interesting. I never thought of it like that. I think I have one more question here for you. We have time for one more question. Do you have any other upcoming books or projects you want people to know about, or?
Sure. Yeah. Thank you. I have another book which will be coming out with Coffee House Press next year, called Pain Blank Blank Book. I've recently published a co-translation with Alex Schumacher of a wonderful book by a Chilean writer named Elvira Hernandez, and that book is called Bodies Found in Various Places. So that's a little bit of what I've been up to.
Continuing the theme with bodies. All right. Thank you so much, Daniel, for being on the air tonight. Daniel has his book, The Murmuring Grief of the Americas, out on Coffee House Press. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
And thank you for having me.
Yeah.
Tune into I Love You, Minneapolis, Forget What I Said Yesterday with Masana's Musings, a series of interviews, conversations, and downloads that highlight the best, worst, and everything in between about Minneapolis and its twin sibling, St. Paul. Each broadcast, crafted with a Black, queer, non-binary, and second-gen Ugandan lens, guides the listener through the immersive, heartbreaking, and redemptive love that Musana's Musings and community members have for the Twin Cities, showcasing the depth and elasticity of their hearts. Sundays at 7 p.m. on KFAI.
Shashank Subramaniam and Abhishek Raghuram, two masters of the South Indian tradition, flute and voice in concert, Friday, May 15th, 7:30 p.m. at the Preeminent Concert Hall at Normandale Community College, 9700 France Avenue, Bloomington. For further information, go to imsom.org. Co-sponsored by the Indian Music Society of Minnesota and KFAI Radio, 90.3 FM Minneapolis, St. Paul, and on the web at kfai.org.
Right on Radio. I'm your host, Emma, and I would like to thank our guests, Mark and Daniel, for their time today. You can learn more about their respective works, again, and The Murmuring Grief of Americas at Coffee House Press. Mark Nowak will also be joining folks at Moon Palace Books next Tuesday. That's next Tuesday, May 12th at 7 p.m. to talk about his discussion about, again, if you wish to listen to him talk in person and ask any other questions. Again, that's going to be at Moon Palace Books at 7 p.m. Next week, Krista Wax will be taking the stage here on Right on Radio. She will have a couple of guests talk about their new books that's going to come out. I will get more details about that. If you wish to follow Right on Radio, you can follow us on Instagram at Right on Radio KFAI. You can also email me righton@kfai.org if you wish to give me any comments, criticisms, if you have any books you would wish us to review. And thank you so much for tuning in. And now, stay tuned for Bonjour, Minnesota. Thank you.